Thanks to a generous donor, we've purchased a building for the new studios and offices of Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and The Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
The donor will match up to $200,000 for the purchase and renovation.
The entire cost is approximately $375,000.
You can view an architect's rendering and make a special tax-deductible gift at issuesetc.org
or call 618-223-8385.
Thanks for your consideration.
With regard to the Supreme Court of the United States, let me say President Trump and I could not be more enthusiastic about the opportunity to see Judge Amy Coney Barrett become Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Your party is actually openly advocating adding seats to the Supreme Court.
Joe Biden will not raise taxes on anyone who makes less than $400,000 a year. He has been very clear about that. Joe Biden will not end fracking. He has been very clear about that. There's the issue of choice, and I will always fight for a woman's right to make a decision about her own body.
Joe Biden and Kamala Harris support taxpayer funding of abortion all the way up to the moment of birth. Late-term abortion. They want to increase funding to Planned Parenthood.
If you have a pre-existing condition, heart disease, diabetes, breast cancer, they're coming for you. Joe Biden has a deep, deep-seated commitment to fight for our democracy.
Senator, your party has spent the last 3.5 years trying to overturn the results of the last election.
That's Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris speaking at Wednesday's vice presidential debate. It was certainly easier to watch, less stress-inducing to watch than the presidential debate of the previous week. What else did we learn, or did we learn anything from this exercise in political theater? Is it more than just political theater? Before the debate, many people were saying, well, this is a vice presidential debate that will really matter. If that's true, why? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the new studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about the vice presidential debate. Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Investigations and Molly Hemingway, senior editor of The Federalist, will be our guest. We'll be talking Galatians and Christian preaching with Pastor Mark Serberg. He's authored a column for the October issue of the Lutheran Witness magazine titled Faith Working Through Love. And then our series on the theology and practice of a Lutheran day school continues with Pastor Peter Bender, director of the Concordia Catechetical Academy. Joining us to discuss the vice presidential debate of last night, Mark Hemingway. He's senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. Mark, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
And Molly Hemingway, she's a Fox News contributor and senior editor of The Federalist. She's co-author of the book Justice on Trial. Molly, welcome.
It is great to be here with you.
Molly, how would you compare and contrast the vice presidential debate with last week's presidential debate?
Well, the vice presidential debate was very different. The debate between Mike Pence, Vice President Mike Pence, and Senator Kamala Harris really put forth different visions for where the two parties want to take the country, and it was just a very different, it was traditional. It was a traditional debate, which I think a lot of people wanted. It's also a little bit boring in the age of Trump when you're used to a little bit more fireworks and whatnot.
Mark, what was your take on the contrast between the presidential and vice presidential debates?
Obviously, it was a much more conventional debate in tone and substance. There was a lot more discussion, certainly, of policy specifics and things like that. I mean, it felt like, in some respects, the time before Trump, where there wasn't this very unconventional politician on stage, and to some extent, Biden was always kind of an outlier among institutional Washington in terms of just kind of how loosey-goosey he was and how generally bad he was with details. I don't think that's the case with Mike Pence, who's an extremely skilled debater, and certainly Kamala Harris prepped for the debate in the way that you would expect, you know, for a major party candidate to do that. But at the same time, you know, we're still in the Trump era. You know, Pence was very clearly articulating Trumpian policies, and in a lot of ways, I think, doing a better job of it than Trump did, certainly, in his first debate.
Molly, you wrote recently in The Federalist that vice presidential debates do matter. Make your case.
Yeah, the conventional wisdom, particularly right after Mike Pence did such a better job in the debate than Kamala Harris did, was that, well, yes, but vice presidential debates don't matter. And it is true that people largely vote for president based on the president and not on the vice president, but that is entirely different than saying that these things don't matter. And I think it's particularly true in a year like this that they matter. They matter because traditional campaigning has been upended, and so there are very limited opportunities for the American people to get to hear from the candidates themselves about what their actual policies are. And they're also important because of the age of the presidential candidates. President Trump was hospitalized last week, so he seems to have done very well with coming out of that, but that still highlights why you care about who the vice president is. Joe Biden would be, you know, the oldest person to be president on the first day he would be in office. I mean, he's older. He's definitely showing the signs of age. And it really matters then who he picked as his running mate. There's also the issue that Mike Pence has always been more important to Trump than he has gotten credit for. In 2016, when people were deciding whether to take a risk on a guy like Donald Trump, Mike Pence had a stellar vice presidential debate performance where he embodied the mindset of a lot of Republican voters, people who are, you know, very respectful and respectable and socially conservative. And he explained why he was so in support of Donald Trump. He spoke for a lot of average Republicans then. He continues to speak for a lot of average Republicans now. And people who wonder how Donald Trump could have such loyalty and such support really should do a better job of understanding Mike Pence, because he really articulates it well. He explains how much of it is based in policy. He shows how much those policies matter to the average Trump voter. And so I think that these debates are important, and this one was important for a lot of Americans.
Do you agree, Mark?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with everything that Molly just said. And just to add on top of the points she's already made about age and other things, the ratings last night seemed to bear out that this debate was fairly significant. I mean, more than 50 million people watched it. That compares to 35 million people in 2016. So clearly people are well aware of the fact that who is vice president is much more significant this year than it is in a lot of other elections.
What was the highlight for Senator Harris, Molly?
I thought that Senator Harris's best response was her very first one, and then it all kind of went downhill from there. She had a very well-prepared response that went into her key campaign theme of the Trump administration not doing a good job with coronavirus, and that really was based on her skill as a prosecutor. So she came right out of the gate with a pretty good case, and then unfortunately for her, it just kind of went downhill from there, because asked for a follow-up, like what she would do, what she and Biden would do differently than the Trump administration had done. She flailed and she never really got her footing. Still, first impressions are important. And that first one, I thought, was her, you know, good for her, the best answer she was able to put together all night.
What do you think the highlight was for Senator Harris, Mark?
I swear we didn't talk about this in advance, but I felt exactly the same way Molly did in terms of, you know, she was best at prosecuting the case against Trump on COVID. And to some extent, I think that was also a strong point for, perhaps the strongest point for Biden in the presidential debate as well. But like Molly said, I don't think that she quite was able to sustain the kind of like focus necessary or, you know, detail oriented rejoinders to what Pence was saying to carry that through the debate. But yeah, she, you know, out of the gate, she was strong with the COVID material.
Molly, do you think that the Trump campaign is making its case that it sufficiently responded to coronavirus?
I don't know how to answer that, in part because so much of the conversation is controlled by the media, and the media are absolutely hysterical about this. They're essentially running the Biden campaign and fully embraced this coronavirus theme and messaging. So it's so overwhelming. I'm not sure if the Trump campaign is doing what it needs to push back. What I thought Pence did an excellent job with is, A, he ran the coronavirus task force, so he actually knows what the administration did, and he's able to talk about it in a very legitimate way. He also explained that the distinctions aren't really about what you would do in a pandemic that is reasonable. And as I pointed out, both Biden and Trump seem to have the same plan for that. But how much you allow the American people to have freedom in how they organize their affairs. this really is the different vision between the two campaigns right now. So when President Trump was hospitalized, a lot of the conventional wisdom in Washington, D.C. was like, this is it. It's over for him. Now that he's gotten coronavirus, he has to admit that it's the worst thing that ever happened in the world and that we have to lock down and we have to keep children banned from schools and we have to shutter businesses and we have to restrict people from worshiping and all this type of stuff. And of course, he comes out a few days later and it is precisely the opposite. And I would argue that that's not a bad thing at all. I've actually written that people in America have been able to handle hardship before. This is absolutely nothing compared to what happened in the Spanish flu. It is very similar to what we had in the 1958 Asian flu in terms of how much of the population it affected. What's different is our response is really intense in a way that a lot of civil libertarians are worried about and a lot of people who care about constitutional government are worried about. And so on the issue of coronavirus, I think it's important that people not forget all of the other issues in play, which are about human flourishing as well and our rights and our liberties.
Mark, what was the highlight for you with regard to Vice President Pence?
Well, I actually think that there were a couple of highlights. In particular, the way that he brought up the issue of court packing and then continued to press the case and made it extremely clear that she was not going to answer whether or not she would take such a radical step, I thought was an extremely effective moment. I also thought the way that he confronted her on economic issues with regard to the Green New Deal and and her conflicting rhetoric about repealing the Trump taxes, you know, which would in effect be a tax increase on most middle class people, was particularly effective. And it was good because he was thinking on his feet. She didn't seem to be able to carry some sort of constant thread and didn't anticipate any sort of attacks that Pence might make based on what she was saying. It just didn't seem like she had a very coherent idea of the policies involved. It was spouting a bunch of talking points without realizing that they left her vulnerable.
We're talking with Mark Hemingway, senior writer for Real Clear Investigations, and Molly Hemingway, senior editor of The Federalist, about the vice presidential debate when we come back. The low point for Senator Harris and the low point for Vice President Pence. Next up in our silent auction, the mic stand, and headphones from the Old Issues Etc. studio. You can place your bid by sending an email to lynn@issuesetc.org or by calling Lynn at 618-223-8385. You can view these items at facebook.com/issuesetc. We'll announce the highest bid on Wednesday, October the 7th, and the winner on Friday, October 9th. Proceeds benefit the new studios of Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and The Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
Have you ever wondered if your investments could do more? I mean, a whole lot more? This is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. When you invest with us, you not only earn a competitive interest rate, but your investment goes to strengthen Lutheran Church Missouri Synod church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations through low-cost loans and services. To learn more, visit lcef.org/invest101.
Lutheranism in the Public Square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Epistle to the Galatians is the epistle I love the most, which I have taken as my wife. It is my Katie von Bora. Those were Martin Luther's words about Paul's letter to the Galatians. It was his beloved epistle, and he wrote some of his best commentaries on it. Read the October issue of the Lutheran Witness, Galatians and the Reformation, to learn more. Witness.lcms.org to learn about it and how to subscribe. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective. Witness.lcms.org.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House. A charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the vice presidential debate with Mark and Molly Hemingway. You have until 3 Central tomorrow, Friday, October the 9th, to place your bid for the mic stand and headphones from the old Issues Etc. studio. The proceeds of our silent auction benefit the new studios and offices of Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and the Word of the Lord Endures Forever. Send your bid to lynn@issuesetc.org. or call 618-223-8385. Molly, what do you think the low point for Senator Harris was last night?
I think the problem for Senator Harris was mostly in the material she had to work with. In the same way that the real high point for Mike Pence was that he has this really successful record of what the Trump administration has done over the last 3.5 years to talk about, and he can talk about it in detail and remind people of all of those successes, whether they're the broad foreign policy successes or domestic policy successes. Kamala Harris was picked because she is the most liberal senator in the Senate, according to some calculations, but she has to hide that. And when you can't run on your record or you're trying to downplay what you actually believe, whether it's about her support for forcing people to pay for abortions through all 9 months of pregnancy, her being one of the original co-sponsors of the Green New Deal, her support for banning fracking, which is a big issue in Pennsylvania, a state that both campaigns are pushing hard for, or her previous support for court packing. You know, these are all things she had to downplay, and it makes it difficult. It's just much easier when you can just talk about what you've done well and not have to hide it. And she had to hide her record, and it was a bit too difficult for her to thread that needle.
Mark Harris's low point?
Gosh, I mean, I don't know if there was a particular one rhetorically, although she certainly walked into some of Mike Pence's barbs, but I think her general demeanor, I feel like someone during debate prep should have told her to keep the facial expressions in check, and she just wasn't able to do it, and it just doesn't come off well, and focus groups after the debate seem to bear that out, that people just were sort of turned off to some extent by her unserious presence at times on the stage.
What was the weakest moment for Vice President Pence, Molly?
Well, I think that he's a great debater. He is an extremely qualified and skillful debater, and he left very few cards on the table unplayed. But he did have to wrap around to actually answer the abortion question, which should have been so easy for someone like Mike Pence, who has a strong record of being pro-life. He was given an opportunity to talk about that, and he kind of deflected, and then he had to come back around and answer. I'm glad he did. Also, that first section on coronavirus when he was on defense, he does fine on defense, but he does much better when he's sort of able to prosecute the case. And so I think the weak parts might have been on defense and just a few times he missed opportunities to really let his record soar.
What about you, Mark?
I felt like there was one question in particular where they were both asked about how they would handle questions about health for the presidents they'd be serving under, and they both punted on it, and I felt like Pence was in a stronger position to answer that question, even with Trump having coronavirus, than Kamala Harris was, considering, you know, Joe Biden's advanced age and definitely some issues surrounding his cognitive decline, and the way he just weirdly punted on the question was, I thought, a little off-putting. So, I mean, I guess that's what I would say.
Well, that brings up, I thought that question, have you had the conversation with your running mate question, was kind of a throwaway, given the fact that we have a constitutional mechanism for dealing with incapacity of a president. And that raises the question of how you think USA Today's Susan Page did in moderating the debate. Molly, you go first.
Yeah, I think she was a bit of a mixed bag. She is a liberal commentator who did cover a wide variety of questions. I thought that was good. She was much less intrusive than some of what we've seen this debate season, and I think that's good. But I don't like how moderators think their job is to keep people from debating each other. It is a debate, and sometimes you need to see the people go after each other. That is particularly true in a media environment where the media believe their job is to protect the Biden campaign. So some of the best parts of the debate were when Mike Pence tried to get Kamala Harris to answer honestly about her plan and Biden's plan to pack the court in retaliation for Republicans following the Constitution. And that wasn't something Susan Page brought up. That was something Mike Pence had to bring up over and over and over. Republicans are having to not just be on the receiving end of a debate, but actually coming up with the questions as well, because moderators, as they become more and more liberal and more beholden to liberal groupthink, are just unwilling or unable to come up with the right questions. A lot of the questions had liberal assumptions built into them or just falsehoods. She was trying to characterize that the country has done worse than any other country in coronavirus response. In fact, our case fatality rate is far lower than so many other developed countries. And she was saying that we haven't had an economic recovery. We are slated to have the biggest quarterly GDP growth in this quarter in history. It's just frustrating when you have to correct the assumptions if you're a Republican and then go on to debate. Whereas if you are a liberal or a Democrat, you kind of just get these things served up to you on a platter. Susan Page was not as bad as some of what we've seen, but she's definitely in that mold.
So what about you, Mark? How do you think Page did?
I mean, this has been a problem in a number of election cycles now. I mean, it's always been a problem to some extent, but the fact that we have a press corps that is unable to, like, cough up one moderator that is capable of offering up neutral questions consistently, or at the very least prosecuting the Democrats as directly as they do to put Republicans on the spot. I mean, it's really just kind of appalling. I mean, why did Pence have to be the guy to bring up the court packing issue? I mean, this seems like would have been, you know, near the top of the list of questions you'd ask, you know, considering the debate over Amy Coney Barrett right now. And, you know, similarly, you know, we saw this in the first presidential debate here where Chris Wallace, he made that comment about why Trump opposed, you know, racial sensitivity training, when we all know that the Trump executive order on critical race theory is something far more pernicious than the diversity training that's existed in corporate America for decades. It is incumbent in their responsibility as journalists to have, like, some idea of their blind spots and biases. And now, I don't think Susan Page did a particularly bad job as far as, you know, moderation of the debates go in terms of what we've come to expect in recent years, but the problem is that the status quo is terrible. I mean, they do not have debate moderators that are capable of formulating questions from a conservative perspective and simply don't seem to want to put Democrats on the spot and ask them tough questions about late-term abortion or ask questions about immigration in a way that show that, you know, a huge number of Americans are concerned about how liberal our immigration policies are. So we just need to do more to hold these people to account. But, you know, until we fix the media, we're not going to fix a lot of the problems in this country.
Molly, we spoke to both of you recently at our Making the Case conference, and we had asked you about the Republican Party post-Trump. Do you think that Mike Pence's performance last night tells us anything about the Republican Party after Donald Trump?
I don't know how much his performance tells us about the party after Trump. I think that no matter what happens on both sides of the aisle, both parties have a lot to think about. And the establishment still struggles with how much the people are frustrated with how the establishment has handled things in this country over recent decades, whether that's how they get us involved in wars that they have no plan to get out of, whether that's how they bail out large capitalist corporations and don't think about how the middle class is affected by trade policy, whether it's immigration policy, and whether we have done a good job of having borders that are meaningful and having new immigrants properly brought into the country. There are all these things that people are very frustrated with, and the establishment seems to just want all those things to go away. I think that no matter, almost like the best thing that could happen for the establishment is if Donald Trump wins another 4 years to kind of continue having these discussions. But I think that the patience that a lot of people have for this old way of doing things in the Republican Party, where they always sort of prepare to lose and they always are beholden to what the media message is and what the media say that they can talk about, I think that's gone. And whether that happens, you know, in a few months or in 4 years, the Republican Party really needs to improve how it handles elite media control of debates and whether they will just continue to allow themselves to be treated as second-class citizens or not. And Donald Trump has given some people a template for that, and mostly built on solid policy successes. Like, he has done things to change our approach to China or our views on war and all of these types of things that give the Republicans a really good way to have a popular playbook going forward. They could do that without some of the downsides of Trump's personality if they choose to, but their real beef with him has never been personality. It's always been policy, and that he views these things differently than they do.
Mark, from what we learned last night, does Kamala Harris give us any indication about the future of the Democratic Party?
I don't know. You know, Kamala Harris clearly has a very liberal voting record. Clearly, to some extent, her selection, I think, was an attempt to mollify the more liberal wing of the party that was not happy that, say, Biden edged out Sanders out of the primary by appealing to more, you know, mainstream centrist Democrats. So I will say that the concession to identity politics and the fact that since Biden won the nomination by presenting himself as an alternative to the socialist Bernie Sanders, they've been, instead of tacking to the center like most Democratic candidates usually, like most candidates do after they seize the nomination, they've actually been tacking leftward in substance while letting the media still present Kamala and Joe Biden as representatives of a centrist Democratic Party that doesn't really exist anymore. Now, in the case of Kamala, she was never a centrist, and she's trying to play one on television like last night, and I just think it's very insincere, and to some extent it is telling about the direction of the Democratic Party. They're lucky enough to have a compliant media that is willing to put the most electable face on them while they continue to veer leftward, and I think that shows in the selection of Kamala Harris.
Molly, will there be another presidential debate? If so, when and what's the format?
I don't know when or where, but it absolutely needs to happen. And the presidential debate commission, or whatever you call it, has just been a disaster this year. Right after Mike Pence has this successful debate, they say that they have unilaterally decided to change the rules on the debate in order to help Joe Biden by having a virtual debate. They didn't get buy-in from the president or even the Biden campaign at that point. And they already are being accused of setting up these debates in a way that helps out liberals. Donald Trump says the elites are trying to rig the game and steal it from him. And then they go and sort of prove his point. It was just an unbelievably unnecessary error. They need to have debates. The American people have a right to them. And it doesn't matter if, you know, people are worried about how Biden will do. People have a right to hear how Joe Biden will do things if he's elected president. They have a right to have tough questions asked of Donald Trump as well. And so I think one of the biggest failures has been this presidential debate commission. And we need a radical change where they figure out a way to get these people to actually debate each other and hear how they differ instead of these tightly controlled and moderated interruption fests that we've seen thus far.
Finally, then Mark, what are your thoughts on that subject?
There has been a problem, I think, for some time now in terms of, we used to have these quote-unquote nonpartisan groups like the Presidential Debate Commission and the League of Women Voters and things like that that did a lot of things to facilitate the electoral process in this country, and they were generally understood and appreciated to be sort of nonpartisan actors that did general voter education and things like that. I think increasingly, again, over the last number, however many election cycles or decades, we have seen these organizations basically like tip over into some sort of default center-left worldview, and they are unable to keep their own personal politics from interfering in their decisions when it comes to, you know, important things where we need institutions that can facilitate, say, nonpartisan forums, you know, and you know, that's as true as the media industry as it is, you know, the Presidential Debate Commission. We need some institutions in this country that are capable of being objective and not succumbing to party politics, and it is frankly depressing and alarming that there aren't many, if any, left.
You can read Mark and Molly Hemingway's columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Mark Hemingway is senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. Mark, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Hemingway is a Fox News contributor, senior editor of The Federalist, and co-author of the book Justice on Trial. Molly, thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll be talking Galatians and Christian preaching. If you look at the book of Galatians, there's a big, strong argument from the Apostle Paul against works having anything to do with your salvation, but does that mean he has nothing to say about your works? We'll answer that question next.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll continue our study of St. Matthew with not peace, rewards. A question from St. John the Baptist. Jesus reflects on the Baptist and never satisfied. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
During a global pandemic, how can we find comfort in the hymn, From God Can Nothing Move Me? You'll find the answer in Pastor Will Wheaton's column on Lutheran Dirges and Such in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Rapper Flame details his journey from Bapticostal and Reformed Baptist Calvinism to Confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal.
Our Christian faith is under constant attack, and we must be proactive in keeping our children in the church. At Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas, we believe that an education rooted in God's Word is one that stands against the very gates of hell. Nothing in this world is more important. Offering a rigorous classical Lutheran education, we provide in-person and live online remote learning opportunities for preschool through grade 12. To learn more, visit flsplano.org, flsplano.org.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
When Martin Luther preached the dedication for the Torgau Church, he asserted that nothing else happened in this house but that our dear Lord speak to us and we respond in prayer, thanksgiving, and praise.
Issues Etc. guest Dr. John Pless.
The same could be said of Concordia Theological Seminary. This is a place where our Lord speaks to us through His Word, and we respond in joyful and thankful confession. We therefore invite you to visit our campus, where the Word of Christ dwells among us richly.
Learn more about studying for the vocations of pastor or deaconess at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Forming servants in Jesus Christ to teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, ctsfw.edu or 1-800-481-2155.